It's great to be here with you tonight to see many faces that I recognize. It's been a while since I've been here to speak. I know I used to come regularly, especially during the days when Peg Cantwell was here. She used to twist my arm to get me to speak at every possible opportunity. And this is a very familiar place here in Stone Hall because my wife and I got married here at National Presbyterian. Dick Halverson, if some of you remember him, was the person that married us. And then we had our reception down here. And we had a band up here and dancing. And Dick Halverson sang, "I'm in the Mood for Love." You ever heard him sing that? I don't know if any of you know him. He used to be a vaudeville singer, I guess. So I have many good memories in this particular church and particularly in this room as well. So it's tough to follow Earl Palmer on C.S. Lewis because he's the best. I know we had him a number of different times for the C.S. Lewis Institute. And we loved any time we could get him because he's so dynamic on C.S. Lewis. I remember this one time where we had him, where we had Friday night and all day Saturday lectures. And by Saturday afternoon, I was exhausted. And I thought I couldn't stay awake during this talk right after lunch. And Earl was up there, and not only did I stay awake, but I was riveted, you know, to every word. It was just an amazing talk. So you're privileged to have him here. I also used to hear him. I was on the board of an organization in Berkeley, and I used to go to his church when he was there. And just loved his sermons. So it's good to be here and be part of this series. I'm going to be speaking about C.S. Lewis on Reason and Imagination. And I hope it will be helpful to you, not only to give you more clarity about Lewis, but the importance of reason and imagination for our lives and for our witness to people in the world. So that's what I want to look at. Let's start out with a word of prayer and offer up this time to the Lord. Lord, we thank you for this time where we can come together and consider your servant C.S. Lewis and what he has to teach us. We pray for your presence. As we think and as we consider. And I pray that the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts might be acceptable to you, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. I know Earl has been speaking to you about C.S. Lewis, and I'm not sure exactly what he's dealt with or what he's going to deal with yet, but from having heard what he has done, I decided I would jump in, and if I touch over things that he's done, I'll try to not be too exhaustive or exhausting on them. But I wanted to give a little introduction to why I think Lewis has been such a powerful communicator in this society. Just quickly, for those of you who might be new, how many are here for the first time to this series? Got a few? All right. C.S. Lewis was Oxford Don. He was born November 29th, 1898, died November 22nd, 1963, which happens to be the same day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Thus, C.S. Lewis did not get noticed very much, as he might have on that day. He made a big splash and got to be known in America because he was on the front cover of Time magazine on September 8, 1947. And it had a big full-page picture of his face. And under it, it said, "Oxford C.S. Lewis, his heresy, Christianity." In other words, the shock was that here was a sophisticated Oxford professor at the top of his game in English literature. And he was writing books on things like Screwtape Letters, which I think Earl's talking about next time. He actually believed not only in miracles, and he was just writing the book Miracles as well. He believed in the supernatural, and he believed in the demonic. What a shock for people back in that period of time. And it was quite a favorable article, actually. And I have it, if you're interested. He became very famous in England because of some BBC radio broadcasts that became the book Mere Christianity. It said that during that point, he was the best-known radio voice in Britain, except for Winston Churchill, that people used to be sitting in the pubs, and when Lewis would come on with this BBC address, which was fairly short, they would tell everybody to be quiet, turn up the radio, at least this is one account, and listen to what he had to say. It was of great help in that time of struggle there in the United Kingdom. He made an impact in various areas. In the academic arena, he's particularly well known for a couple excellent books, English Literature in the 16th Century and Allegory of Love, which were both award-winning books and certainly deserve still to be read in the area of English literature. But it's rather amazing around those books that he was so thorough. For instance, English Literature in the 16th Century, he felt like he had to read every book in English written in the 16th century before he wrote the book. So it took him 16 years, and he went to the Bodleian Library there in Oxford, which is a massive library. It's not only the books that are on the shelves, but they're, as I've been told, miles of subterranean tunnels with books as well. And he felt he had to read all those books. And he not only read them, but he had an amazing capacity to recall what he read. In fact, it said that he was cursed by the ability not to forget anything that he ever read. Had a really instant recall. And I tell a couple stories about this in my book. One short account of that is one time he was at his going away party when he moved from Oxford to Cambridge. He was having dinner, I believe it was at Magdalen College. And he just happened to make the comment that he was having difficulty writing poetry because certain lines of poetry would pop into his mind uninvited, and he would remember after he'd written them that they were actually plagiarized or from something else that he remembered. So he had to, you know, cut them out. And he just made the comment that I can't forget anything I've ever read. And they challenged him on that. He said, surely not everything. He said, well, yes, everything. And he thought perhaps people would let it go. But one of the men there took some time, went over to the Magdalen Library, took a book off the shelf, a book of Little Red Poetry, opened it up at random to a particular page and said, have you read this book? And C.S. Lewis said, yes. And started to read a few lines. And Lewis proceeded. He kind of lifted his head and in a very powerful, his rich, powerful voice, quoted about 10 more lines of the poem and kind of left off. And everyone was rather silent for a while before conversation got going at that table. He had a prodigious memory, combined with very sharp analytical skills, a great voice, razor-sharp mind, analytical skills, ability to logically order things as he presented them in his writing or in his speaking. So it was a phenomenal gift that he had to be able to communicate, either in the spoken word or in the written word. In apologetics, giving a defense for faith or reasons for faith, he wrote a number of books, Mere Christianity, Miracles, Screwtape Letters, Problem of Pain, Abolition of Man, Great Divorce, all of which I think are worth your time and your reading. In fiction, of course, we know the Narnia Chronicles, and we're privileged to have a couple of those films and the Voyage of the Dawn Treader coming up next. And I'm glad that they're finally getting even more notice than they've gotten. He also wrote the Space Trilogy and another novel, Till We Have Faces, all of which I think are worth your time. In poetry, it's interesting, he wrote quite a number of poems. And this was the area, at least when he set out in his profession, that he wanted to make most impact. He wanted to be something of a poet laureate of England. And although he tried his hand at poetry, I think when you read it, you'll find some good sections, some good lines. But he wasn't excellent, I would say, or at the top class in his poetry as he was in some other areas. And perhaps that's comfort for us. You know, if we set out with a particular goal and we don't succeed, perhaps we're made for something else, as Lewis found out. And sometimes, even though you may be brilliant, there may be areas of weakness academically. Like poetry was a relative weakness compared to his other strengths. Another interesting story about Lewis was he almost didn't get into Oxford. Even though he's brilliant and he had read a lot and he had this incredible mind, one of the requirements for Oxford is that you had to pass an exam in math in order to get in. Well, twice he failed that exam. And the only way he got into Oxford is he had fought in the First World War, and they made an exemption for anybody coming back from the war that you didn't have to take the math exam. That's the only way he got into Oxford. And if he wouldn't have gotten into Oxford, we probably wouldn't have had all the books and the stories that we have today. So it's another reflection. Just because you or your kids or your grandkids have a weakness, say, in math or some other area, doesn't mean you're dumb, you know, because Lewis was obviously very brilliant. Certainly we know a lot more about Lewis now than we have culturally speaking. So it's a real opportunity to use Lewis as a jumping-off point to talk about the faith. We had the films Shadowlands, the BBC version, and later the Hollywood version, with Anthony Hopkins and Claire Bloom, or Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. The BBC version was Josh Ackland and Claire Bloom, and both are excellent. I would say that the Hollywood version is deficient as far as some of the facts go, but nevertheless very powerful emotionally. I once asked Douglas Gresham, C.S. Lewis' stepson, about the Hollywood version of Shadowlands, and he admitted that there were a number of factual inaccuracies. But his comment on that was, it was emotionally true. In other words, it caught up the power of the emotions there. In other words, if you haven't seen the film, if you can sit through the film without your heart being moved, you have a heart of steel, because it's one of these films that's extremely powerful emotionally. And I think despite the inaccuracies, it touched people and got people to go out and learn more about C.S. Lewis and read his books. Of course, even more recently, we know about Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe and Prince Caspian, which has even more put C.S. Lewis on the map. And we have, I hope, the rest of the Narnia Chronicles ahead of us. And maybe even Screwtape Letters, which has been done as a stage play. I saw it here in D.C. when that came out. And perhaps, who knows, it will become a movie. Or perhaps we'll have the Space Trilogy someday made into a film. Well, there are many reasons, I suppose, as I've already alluded to, why C.S. Lewis is so popular. But what would be the key reason? Well, I'm going to at least take a shot at it. Earl may disagree with me and take something else. But I would say the key reason at the heart of it is the way C.S. Lewis combined both reason and imagination in the pursuit of putting forth his faith. Other culture shapers had the ability to work equally in both the area of reason and the area of imagination. For instance, the atheist Jean-Paul Sartre was able to write philosophy, such as his book Being and Nothingness. He was also able to write drama, such as his play No Exit and other plays. So he was able to communicate in both mediums. Similarly, C.S. Lewis had the same talent. For instance, he was able to write philosophically about his critique of relativism in society in his book Abolition of Man, and then write about it in his novelized form of addressing that in the last one of the Space Trilogy, Abolition of Man. That Hideous Strength, sorry. In That Hideous Strength, the last one of the Space Trilogy. And so it was a very powerful in the way he was able to do that. For instance, he took his Chronicles of Narnia. And one of the very interesting things is this. He was able to take all of his major philosophical ideas and really put it into the Narnia Chronicles so that it comes right down to where children live. Now, that's an amazing talent, to be able to take the very heavy philosophical things and write it so that children can understand it and grasp it. I know I've read to my boys, who are now 14 and 16, but when they're about 5 and 7, and maybe another time a little bit later, I read through the Narnia Chronicles, and they appreciated it and loved it, But I think I often got more excited about it than they did, because I could see that level upon level, depth upon depth, that was there in the Narnia Chronicles. So he had that phenomenal ability in the realm of imagination to put the profound thinking or reason or philosophy, theology, into those books. So he followed the way of reason and imagination. He put it like this. This is at the end of an essay in Selected Literary Essays, and it's a very funny title for the chapter. It's Bluespheels and Flanispheres. There are a couple made-up words that he talks about the meaning of words. And at the very end of that essay, here's what he says. Reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning. Let me say that again. Reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the organ of meaning. And what he argued there is you don't understand any set of ideas until you have pictures and metaphors with which to associate it. You don't even understand a word, he maintains, unless you have some kind of picture or metaphor, some image with which to grasp it. If it's all abstraction and removed from anything concrete, we don't get it. It's a very important insight, and it's one that, of course, Lewis was great. In his Narnia Chronicles, he could write philosophy, but in Mere Christianity or many of his other writings, he has just the right picture or image in the midst of a paragraph to make, to drive his points home. So you say, aha, I get it. And he writes very graphically in terms of images. He was, I think, part of his genius. He was able to work equally well in both arenas. He was able to write theology with graphic images and able to write novels containing theology. Well, I've got some various areas I want to look at in C.S. Lewis, and particularly his conversion and the way he dealt with myth in relation to the human imagination. And perhaps if we have time, extending awareness in children's stories are the four areas that I want to look at. First of all, the place of imagination and reason within his conversion. It was important for him and thus important for the way he wanted to communicate the gospel to others. There were three basic areas. If I had a board up here, that's okay. I don't need it. You can use your imagination. Yeah. You have three concentric circles. The outside circle is imagination. The second inside circle is reason. And the innermost circle is will. And really, in his coming to faith, yeah, first his imagination was baptized. Then his reason was satisfied. And third, his will was submitted. Let me talk quickly about that, because it's important for Lewis, but it's also important for the approach that he uses in addressing other people as well. He was brought up in a rather nominal Anglican home. And he did go through confirmation, although by that time he actually was a non-believer. And he thinks that it's one of the great acts of cowardice, one of the great sins that he committed, that he went through confirmation for his dad's sake, rather than stand up and really tell his dad what he really did not believe at that point. And so during his high school years, he was not a believer, either a very strong atheist or certainly a skeptic. And there are a number of things that contributed to that. If you read Surprised by Joy, you'll get a larger account of it. But one of the things that started him on the road back was he was had a long train ride. And so he went into a bookstore at the train station, and he picked a little book up by George MacDonald called Fantasties. And I don't know if he knew anything about MacDonald or about the book at all. He just happened to get it off the shelf. But as he read it on the train, he said something started to happen to him. Something leapt off the page at him and baptized his imagination. And he was different thereafter. And later he was able to describe that quality as being holiness. or goodness that altered his view of the world. He got a taste for something that he had not really experienced quite in the same way before. He said it took a long time for the rest of him to catch up with his baptized imagination, but eventually he did. He started to realize, too, during this period, a contradiction emerging between his reason and his imagination. He was of the frame of mind of some of the atheists of that day. For instance, he doesn't mention Bertrand Russell, as I recall, but Bertrand Russell would say, as an atheist, you've got to build your life on the basis of unyielding despair. So the idea of a very, very gray, meaningless universe was what he was imagining his atheism led to. Not exactly like the new atheists of our day, Dawkins, Harrison, Hitchens. But there started to be a contradiction between that, his philosophy of atheism, this gray, meaningless perspective, and the things that he loved in his imagination. He was brought up reading great novels and books and myths where truth, goodness, and beauty were wrestled with. And so he was, in his aspirations, he was dealing with meaning and dignity and all of the richness of life, but in the imagination. And the question was his imagination a dead-end street? Was it full of sound and fury signifying nothing? Or did it really point somewhere or have any significance beyond that? Here's the way he puts it in Surprised by Joy. Such then was the state of my imaginative life. Over against it stood the life of my intellect. The two hemispheres of my mind were in the sharpest contrast. On the one side, a many-islanded sea of poetry and myth, and on the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary. Nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. So he was kind of pushing himself to the logical conclusion of his assumptions on atheism and pushing himself towards an adequate basis for his highest aspirations in his reading of literature. He also started to notice that the books he was reading were turning against him. Now, according to his philosophy, he had a love for the various atheist books that were written. But he also had a love for these books that happened to have been written, he found out later, by Christians. Here's the way he puts it. All the books were beginning to turn against me. Indeed, I must have been blind as a bat not to have seen long before the ludicrous contradiction between my theory of life and my actual experiences as a reader. George MacDonald had done more to me than any other writer. Of course, it was a pity he had this bee in his bonnet about Christianity. He was good in spite of it. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, had more sense than all the other moderns put together, baiting, of course, his Christianity. Johnson, that is Samuel Johnson, was one of the few authors whom I felt I could trust utterly. Curiously enough, he had the same kink. Spencer and Milton, by strange coincidence, had it too. Even among the ancient authors, the same paradox was to be found. The most religious, such as Plato and Virgil, were clearly those on whom I could really feed. On the other hand, those writers who did not suffer from religion, and with whom my sympathy ought to have been complete, Shaw and Wells and Mill and Gibbon and Voltaire, all seemed a little thin. What we as boys called tinny. It wasn't that I didn't like them. They were all, especially Gibbon, entertaining, but hardly more. There seemed to be no depth in them. They were too simple. The roughness and density of life did not appear in their books. The upshot of it all could be nearly expressed in a perversion of Roland's great line in the chanson. Christians are wrong, but all the rest are bores. Boring. So his reason and his imagination were in tension and pushing him in various directions, really both in some ways towards Christ. He had various rational objections that needed to be addressed. And you'll see those in Surprised by Joy, and I also address those in my book, C.S. Lewis's Case for Christ. So I'm not going to address those right now, but he had certain of those objections he had to deal with. And then he finally came to submit his will to God, and it wasn't a dramatic conversion. In fact, it was very unemotionless, or relatively emotion-free. He said he felt the unrelenting approach of the one whom he desperately desired not to meet. And he finally knelt in his rooms there at Magdalen College in Oxford. He said, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. So not exactly a dramatic conversion. We'll see his conversion to Christ was also not a great emotional conversion. We'll see that in a minute. All right, so that his imagination was baptized, his reason satisfied, and finally his will submitted. Well, one of the rational objections that had to be addressed along the way was the issue of myth. He'd been taught about the myths in his public school education, and it was always indicated explicitly or implicitly that all these myths were false, but Christianity true, even though there were some parallels between Christianity and some of these other myths. And so that caused him some trouble. First of all, though, before we address that, let me give you his definition of miracles. His definition of myth. It was in his book, Miracles. His definition of myth was a real, though unfocused, gleam of divine truth falling on human imagination. Again, myth is a real, though unfocused, gleam of divine truth falling on human imagination. He'd always been fascinated with mythology. Ever since he was a child, he would read the great myths. Particularly, he loved the great northern myths, Scandinavian and Icelandic mythology, which just captivated him. Just one illustration of this in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. As a young man, he even saw just one illustration from Siegfried and Twilight of the Gods, and it's as if the sky turned around in his perspective. He said, pure northernness engulfed me, a vision of huge clear spaces hanging above the Atlantic in the endless twilight of the northern summer. Remoteness, severity, the memory of joy itself. Now, when he got to Oxford, he found out about a little group that studied Icelandic mythology. And interestingly, it was led by a man, J.R.R. Tolkien. And he had to learn Icelandic to join the group. And he decided to join the group, and he did find that quite a number of the people in this group happened to be committed Christians who believed in the supernatural. In other words, they were more orthodox in their inclination. But he was captivated by this mythology and the study of it. He says later that when he came to Christ, he was a converted pagan living in the midst of apostate Puritans. By the way, it's interesting, his first meeting of Tolkien was at a faculty meeting, and he wasn't too impressed. He went back and wrote down in his diary that Tolkien was a pale, fluent chap, only needing a smack or so. So not exactly an indication of the kind of incredible close friendship that they had throughout their lives later on. In any case, Lewis's early objection to Christianity was along the lines of myth in the way I indicated. Here's what he says. No one ever attempted to show in what sense Christianity fulfilled paganism or paganism prefigured Christianity. The accepted position seemed to be that religions were normally a mere farrago of nonsense, though our own by fortunate exception was true. But on what grounds could I believe this exception? It obviously was in some general sense the same kind of thing as the rest. Why was it so differently treated? Need I, at any rate, continue to treat it differently? I was very anxious not to. Well, along the way of some of these discussions, he and Tolkien started to get together regularly for breakfast and then an occasional dinner. One time they had dinner at Magdalen College, and it was Tolkien and Lewis and Dyson and perhaps another professor there, and they had a great dinner. And perhaps during the dinner, C.S. Lewis said, myths are lies. And Tolkien said, no, they're not. And so the debate was on, and they ended up having a discussion well into the evening. They ended up went out and walked around the grounds of Magdalen College in the cold and the wind, and their talk went on till about 3 or 4. I think at 3 o'clock in the morning, Tolkien went home, but he and Dyson continued to talk. And it was a very momentous night in C.S. Lewis' life, because that evening he had that objection addressed in a very powerful and dramatic way. Tolkien argued something like this, although it's hard to go through all of the details of the argument in a short scope. I cover it in the chapter in my book. But Tolkien argued something like this. It's not surprising that there are myths that are out there in the culture. I think Earl often uses the illustration, and he may have already used it, that there are only about 8 basic stories that are out there, and all the other stories are just a variation of these 8 basic stories. Now, there are certain patterns that the human mind gravitates towards, certain things that are somehow built into the structure of the universe, certain thoughts and ideas, and it's not surprising that there would be similar stories that would arise. The only question is this. Of these stories, are there some stories that are more true than others? Or, you might say, are there some, or maybe one, in which the myth has actually become fact, has become history, has become real? And that's what Tolkien was arguing to Lewis, that Jesus was the myth become fact, that all these stories had echoes of things that pointed forward to the time of Christ. It was kind of a pre-evangelism, a kind of preparation for the coming of Christ. What Tolkien called the great U catastrophe. Has Earl talked about that? The great EU, the good catastrophe. In other words, in all great stories, there's often that kind of catastrophe that's at the height. A tragedy that turns out for the good. And it's at the root, especially, of fairy stories. And in these fairy stories, you see something of the truth of the gospel. There is, ultimately, within reality, the happily ever after, but which comes through tragedy. All right, so that there's something in the great fairy stories that's an indication of the nature of the way things actually are. Another step along the way was examining the gospel narratives. Well, before I do that, let me just say that not too long after that all-night talk, Lewis was riding to the Whipsnade Zoo in the sidecar of a motorcycle. His brother Warren was driving the motorcycle, and C.S. Lewis was riding in the sidecar. And when he left for the Whipsnade Zoo, he did not believe Jesus Christ was the Son of God. But when he arrived at the zoo, he did believe. Yet nothing had really happened in between. He said, it's just as if I was awake for the first time. You know, like the first moment where you wake up in the morning. He said that's what it was like. He could see the truth of Christ for the first time, whereas before he couldn't. So it wasn't a spectacular emotional conversion to Christ either. Another step was examining the gospel narratives. He said, I was by now too experienced in literary criticism to regard the gospels as myths. They had not the mythical taste. Yet the very matter which they set down in their artless historical fashion was precisely the matter of the great myths. If ever myth had become fact, had been incarnated, it would be just like this. Here and here only, in all time, the myth must have become fact. The word flesh, God-man. This is not a religion nor a philosophy. It's the summing up and actuality of them all. And this was the key to how he later came to regard other religions. He said, if you're a Christian, you do not have to believe that all the other religions are simply wrong all through. If you're an atheist, you do have to believe that the main point in all the religions of the whole world is simply one huge mistake. But if you're a Christian, you're free to think that all these religions, even the queerest ones, contain at least some hint of the truth. But you have to remember, even as I use this word myth, he was maintaining that it was true and it was historical. And as a matter of fact, he said this, that if the gospel, if the incarnation really happened, if God really did come in the flesh, if he lived a perfect life, if he died for our sins, if he was raised from the dead, if he has ascended into heaven as the risen Lord, if these things actually happened, if they're true, it's of infinite importance. If true, of infinite importance. If it's not true, he said, it's of no importance, except as a kind of cultural artifact. But the one thing, he said, it cannot be, is of moderate importance. Again, if true, of infinite importance. If not true, of no importance. The one thing it cannot be is of moderate importance. So in using this idea of myth, he was not compromising the idea of truth here. He also found imagination to be very important in extending our awareness of life. He's one who loved literature. And he took an approach that's diametrically opposed to or opposite from the deconstructionist postmodern philosophy of our day. I'm not going to take a long time to develop that right now, but for those of you who know about it, you perhaps can have the ears to hear. For instance, one professor coming from this more deconstructionist perspective wanted to destroy his students' love of literature. At the very root of this approach, this more deconstruction approach, is the idea that we need to interrogate texts, read between the lines, read against the grain, find out beneath the text, be suspicious of the motives of the writer is really the first rule, and try to find sexism, racism, ethnocentrism, whatever kind of motives underlying the text. Now, those things may be there, to be sure, but to really start with that mentality of suspicion at the very first point is the exact opposite of what Lewis set out to do. In fact, what he said is that his goal was to receive literature. He said, look, listen, receive. Get yourself out of the way. Many use, but few receive literature. He loved especially seeing the world through other people's eyes. He said, my own eyes are not enough for me. I will see through those of others. Reality, even seen through the eyes of many, is not enough. I will see what others have invented. Literary experience heals the wound without undermining the privilege of individuality. In reading great literature, I become 1,000 men, yet remain myself. Here as in worship, in love, and in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself and am never more myself than when I do. I went on to argue that without this exposure to other views of life, other perspectives on the world through literature, he said, one may be full of goodness and good sense, but he inhabits a tiny world. In it, we should be suffocated. The man who's contented to be only himself, and therefore less a self, is in prison. So his first thought was, read other great literature, other writers from all different kinds of perspectives. And at least for a while, suspend your judgment. Don't come in there suspicious. Be open enough to listen and receive. Be able to hear the way that person experiences life, to be able to see the world, in a sense, through their eyes, to be able to experience the world as they experience it. That was his first thought. And it's a sense in which this is a loving perspective. Love is at the very core. You need to get out of yourself, he said, when you read a book, and get into the other's perspective. In a great story, you have the sense of getting out, or better, getting into the world that that writer communicates. For instance, Ernest Hemingway, when you read his works, it's just sometimes you lose yourself for 20, 30, 40 pages in the story, and you wake up and you find out you're back in your room. There's something about it that just drives you along, has you live in that other world for a while. That's what a good writer can do. And there's a whole relationship, he said, between literature and love. He said, in the moral sphere, every act of justice or charity involves putting ourselves in the other person's place and thus transcending our own competitive particularity. In coming to understand anything, we're rejecting the facts as they are for us. Yet, the primary impulse of each is to maintain and aggrandize himself. But the cure for this is love. In love, we escape from ourselves into one another. So just as we do that in a relationship, you want to get out of yourself and get into the other person's experience so you can see the world, experience it in some way the way they do. That's also the way he approached literature. So you might contrast the more deconstructionist postmodern view, that the deconstructionists have a kind of perfect fear that casts out love, and C.S. Lewis has a perfect, more perfect love that casts out fear. Now, later on, he would critique and analyze or look for the things that are underneath the text, but that's not the first thing. You need to see the world, enhance your world, allow yourself to see the world through other people's eyes. He also wrote a lot about children's stories, and he certainly wrote children's stories. He, for instance, says that reading children's stories and fairy tales and that kind of thing is important to growing up. One time he had some children in his house during the bombing of London, came out to Oxford. And one little five-year-old had never read any fairy tales. He said his poor imagination had been left without any natural food at all. But what he maintained is that there's a kind of artificial division between children's stories and stories for adults. There's a sense in which a good story is a good story, whether it is, if it's just a good story, it can be read by anybody. I know as my boys were growing up, to read really good books to them, I would get so caught up in the story that, you know, we'd read a chapter a night, and I would stay up late into the night reading the rest of the book because I wanted to know how it came out. And there's something about stories that move us along in that way. In a sense, Lewis argued, when we lose something of our childlikeness, we lose something of our humanity. And of course, Jesus argued along those lines. Unless you approach the kingdom as a little child, you'll not enter the kingdom. Now, not all senses of childlikeness are good. I mean, there's a sense in which, 1 Corinthians 14:20, we should be babes in evil and in our understanding be mature. We're not to remain childlike, it says in 1 Corinthians 13. There's a sense in which we're to grow up and be more mature in some ways. But we're always to retain something of this childlikeness. Here's what Lewis said. Only those adults who have retained with whatever additions or enrichments their first childish responses to poetry unimpaired can be said to have grown up at all. In another place, he says, but who in his senses would not keep, if he could, that tireless curiosity, that intensity of imagination, that faculty of suspending belief, that unspoiled appetite, that readiness to wonder, to pity, and to admire. And in fact, Lewis says about himself, parts of me are still 12, and I think other parts were already 50 when I was 12. Ruth Pitter, who's a friend that knew him quite well, she was very bright and very much into literature. In fact, people thought that Lewis might marry Ruth before Joy came along because they were so close. In any case, Ruth said that Lewis always retained a child's sense of glory and of nightmare. Just one more quote from Lewis on this children's literature topic. He says, "It does not seem useful to say what delighted the infancy of the species naturally delighted the infancy of the individual. Surely it would be less arrogant and truer to the evidence to say that it is they, that is children, who are not peculiar. It's we who are peculiar. Fashions and literary tastes come and go among adults, and every period has its own shibboleths. These, when good, do not improve the tastes of children, and when bad, do not corrupt it. For children read only to enjoy. Of course, their limited vocabulary and general ignorance make some books unintelligible to them. But apart from that, juvenile taste is simply human taste." Very interesting thesis, which I think is fundamentally true. In fact, some people have argued, what is the best age to read the Narnia Chronicles? Some people have argued 5 or 6 years old. Others have argued adolescence, where you're kind of in between being a child and being adult. But I've found people of all ages that have enjoyed reading Narnia. I remember being on a plane once and I met an older woman who was in her 70s. And she said she just read Narnia for the first time and absolutely loved it. Or another man who was in his 40s had read Narnia for the first time. And he was handing out sets to all of his friends because he wanted them to read the books, finding them to be so rich. Lewis particularly enjoyed creating other worlds and reading other people's worlds as well, like Tolkien's or many others. Maybe just one illustration of more piece of prose. I know Earl likes to read some from the Narnia Chronicles. Has he done that yet? Oh, I love to hear him do that. What's that?
We cried.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I'm not going to read from the Narnia Chronicles, but I don't think he reads from the Inner Ring. There's a little essay that he wrote in Weight of Glory. It's called The Inner Ring. And it shows in prose how he uses images and imagination as part of them. Now, we all know the phenomena of the Inner Ring. That some people are in, some people are out, or the idea of cliques or societies, a kind of in-group, out-group. He makes a comment towards the beginning of this essay that some people think they're in when they're out, and other people think they're out when they're in. And he says it's not totally bad that there be an inner circle. I mean, there does need to be, say, in a church or in a sports team, I suppose, or in a various societies, that those people that are making decisions as far as administration goes. But it's not necessarily wrong that there be an inner ring, but it can be. As a matter of fact, he argues it can be a great source of corruption and of evil. Here's what he says. "I believe that in all men's lives at certain periods, and in many men's lives, at all periods between infancy and old age, one of the most dominant elements is the desire to be inside the local ring and the terror of being left outside." Again, this is not necessarily evil, but the desire which draws us into the inner ring is another matter. Has this desire ever caused you to say or do something for which you're later ashamed? He says, "If you do nothing about it, if you drift with the stream, You will, in fact, be an inner ringer. I don't say you'll be a successful one. That's as may be. But whether by pining or moping outside rings you can never enter, or by passing triumphantly further and further in one way or another, you'll be that kind of man. When compromise comes, it will come in no dramatic colors. It'll come in this kind of phrase. We always do it this way." And you'll be drawn in, if you're drawn in, not by a desire for gain or ease, but simply because at that moment, when the cup was so near your lips, you cannot bear to be thrown back again into the cold outer world. It would be so terrible to see that other man's face, that genial, confidential, delightfully sophisticated face, turn suddenly cold and contemptuous, to know that you'd been tried for the inner ring and rejected. powerful writing. Just step back for a second and look at it. That when the cup was so near your lips, to be thrown again into the cold outer world, to see that other person's face, that delightfully sophisticated face. Do you think, can you picture pictures in each one of these elements? Three different times in this these short couple sentences that help give that writing power to be able to grasp it. He says, of all passions, the passion for the inner ring is most skillful in making a man who's not yet very bad do very bad things. Now, the torture allotted to the Danaids in the classical underworld is that of attempting to fill sieves with water. It's the symbol not of one vice, but of all vices. It's the very mark of perverse desire that it seeks what is not to be had. The desire to be inside the invisible line illustrates this rule. As long as you're governed by that desire, you'll never get what you want. You're trying to peel an onion. If you succeed, there'll be nothing left. Until you conquer the fear of being an outsider, you will remain. Now, profound and very much to the point, but again, notice the power of the images here. Fill sieves with water. That desire to be inside the invisible line. Peeling an onion. And we get to the core and there's nothing there. You see how those images allow that writing to drive home with force the things that he's trying to say. He says in another little essay, it's called Connivance. It's in Reflections on the Psalms, something very similar. He said, I'm inclined to think that a Christian would be wise to avoid, where he decently can, any meeting with people that are bullies, lascivious, cruel, dishonest, spiteful, and so forth. Certainly the great temptation of Washington, D.C. is to be either in a position of power or to be close to power. And this desire to come and be accepted, not to say anything inappropriate that would get you to be uninvited to the choice meetings that are out there. In fact, Dr. Jim Houston, who founded the C.S. Lewis Institute, was at one point asked to come back here and live here full time. And there may have been very various reasons why he didn't, like his wife wanted to live in Vancouver. But other than that, he said he might find the spiritual temptation of being in Washington, D.C. too great. I found that very interesting to hear from such a godly man as he. And the reason we ought to avoid this company, Lewis says, is not because we're too good for them. In a sense, he says, it's because we're not good enough. We're not good enough to cope with all the temptations, nor clever enough to deal with all the problems which an evening spent in such society produces. The temptation is to condone, to connive at, but in our words, looks, and laughter, to consent. You know, to what exactly is the appropriate way to deal with things you profoundly disagree with? Do you laugh with a crowd? Do you stand up and preach to them? You're sort of more holier than thou. I mean, what do you say and do? That's why it's a difficult situation. It takes incredible wisdom to know how to even handle it without losing your soul, without you losing your conscience. He says, lead us not into temptation, often means, among other things, deny me those gratifying invitations, those highly interesting contacts, that participation in the brilliant movements of our age, which I so often, at such risk, desire. Well, not that we may not be so called. Perhaps many of you are called into that arena. But beware. Put on the whole armor of God, because there's real temptation there. He said, the quest for the inner ring will break your hearts unless you break it. But if you do break it, a surprising result will follow. If in your working hours you make your work your end, you will presently find yourself all unawares inside the only circle that really matters. Our primary goal should be to seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Okay, just to bring it to a close here. Imagination, then, was the beginning of Lewis's conversion and an important dimension in his view of religions and mythologies. It was also significant to his perception of the world and integral to maintaining a kind of childlikeness. Just a couple thoughts on its importance for us. I think that as we approach the culture, there are people that are on a spectrum. And my normal rule of thumb goes like this. The more open somebody is to hearing about the faith, the more direct you can be in approaching them. But the more closed people are, the more indirect forms of communication you need to use. And by indirect, I mean questions, riddles, stories, parables, short statements, particularly through the realm of the imagination. In fact, this is where Lewis later speaks about it himself. It's not that he ignored rational defenses and arguments or historical arguments, but there are times where the imagination can, as he says, baptize the imagination, or another way he puts it is get past the watchful dragons of our religiosity that prevent us from hearing the message of the gospel. Sometimes the words become so tired to us, so old, so much God words, that they don't have the striking force or the drama or the power that they could really have. And he says sometimes by using the imagination, as in Narnia, you can perhaps baptize the imagination of others or get past the watchful dragons. Or he says in response to there were various reviews of his book, Out of the Silent Planet, that came in, and only a couple of out of 60 even knew that it had anything to do with faith. You know, and really, it's very profound. You have the creation and fall and a kind of redemption that's there in the book. But he says that it's really come to a rather strange place where you can smuggle all kinds of theology into people's minds without them even knowing it. And Lewis felt that perhaps that might be his place. There's much that's been written about the moral imagination. There's a sense in which we can often grasp things more profoundly, not just by putting up a list of rules, but through stories, through seeing the true and the good through the realm of the beautiful, seeing the adventure of living the moral life. It's not just a list of codes, but it's something very profound. Don't be afraid of myth. We must not be ashamed of the mythical radiance, he says, in our theology. We must not be nervous about parallels in pagan Christ. They ought to be there. It would be a stumbling block if they weren't. If God is mythopoeic, perfect myth and perfect fact, then the gospel is addressed to the savage, the child, and the poet in each one of us, no less than to the moralist, the scholar, and the philosopher. There's a sense in which, too, as we look at reason and imagination, that we see the comprehensive nature of the gospel. The way Chesterton put it in Orthodoxy is this. He says, a man is partially convinced when he's found this or that proof for a thing and can expound it. But a man is not really convinced of a philosophical theory when he finds that something proves it. He's only convinced when he finds that everything proves it. And the more converging reasons he finds pointing to this conviction, the more bewildered he is if asked to suddenly sum them up. The very multiplicity of proof, which ought to make reply overwhelming, makes it impossible. So we ought to understand that it's not just when you can prove something, but it's only when we see that everything proves it that we really come to believe. And Lewis puts this in a couple lines. At the end, the last line of his essay is Theology Poetry. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun is risen, not because I see it clearly, but because by it I see everything else. There's a sense in which C.S. Lewis helps us through his vision, and Christ helps us through the vision of life, to see the various pieces of the puzzle and how they fit together. Or another illustration might be a bunch of keys. You know, if you've ever had a bunch of keys and you know that one of those keys will unlock the lock, but you don't know which one. You have to try the various keys. C.S. Lewis came to believe that Jesus is the key that unlocks the lock. He's the one that helps you to have that perspective on the nature of life.